Case number 09-3071, United States of America v. Jaron Bryce, also known as Jay Bird, also known as Daddy, also known as Bird, also known as Jay, appellant. Mr. Jeffress for appellant, Ms. Bates for appellee.
Mr. Jeffress.
Thank you. May it please the court. Your Honors, Mr. Bryce received a 25-year sentence, which is obviously a very substantial sentence given that this was his first felony offense. So particularly under those circumstances, it is vital that the sentencing was performed correctly and that it was based on reliable information, that all of the procedural requirements of sentencing were met. But for the numerous reasons we've set forth in our brief, they were not, and we submit that the district court's perception of the conduct in this case was far worse than what was proven. We've laid out a number of claims in our brief I can address, but the most narrow ground for reversal of the sentence and remand is the district court's factual finding that the relevant conduct in this case included six victims under the age of 16, when in fact the record evidence supported only one. To briefly review the facts, the defense allocated at length for a sentence of 120 months at the resentencing. The defense discussed how Mr. Bryce had changed since this happened, but also sentences in comparable cases, which were in the vast majority nowhere close to 30 years or 25 years. The district court's very first point in response to the defense's allocution was that the defense had made a number of good arguments, but, quote, in fact, in this case, as I recall, there were seven women involved, six of whom were under the age of 16 when they encountered Mr. Bryce. Remember, we had some who testified and some who didn't. Now, significantly, government counsel at the resentencing, who was the only other person in the room who had had access to the material witness proceedings, never corrected the district court's misstatement regarding the number of underage victims at no point in the resentencing, and the district court never corrected itself. Faced with those indisputable facts, the government concedes that the district court was mistaken in its statement, but argues that the district court's subsequent use of ambiguous language concerning the age of the victims somehow implicitly retracted the district court's statement. Or second, that the district court did not rely on this finding in assessing the 3553 factors.
Then you pointed out the age issue, as I read the transcript, and the court then referred to young women. Young women's an accurate term, correct?
Well, it's very loose language later in the – I mean, we only have one clear statement about what the district court thought about the ages of the victims, mm-hmm. and that was that there were six victims under the age of 16. It's an express and clear statement. Now, outside of that –
And you prefaced this by saying you wanted to make your record, which you did, and talk about the number of victims, and one was underage.
Right.
And then the district court says, refers to young women. And I think the number of women is described in the pre-sentence report, right? And it had been discussed at the initial sentencing, so.
Right. Well, what happened was is we objected and said, look, there's never been any relevant conduct finding. And, of
right.
course, we're operating on the information that's been presented at trial or elsewhere, but we have no idea and still have no idea what happened in the material witness hearings.
But the pre-sentence report, you had mm-hmm. that too, right?
It did identify, the pre-sentence report identified seven women. But mm-hmm. I think then we subsequently made clear that our objection is not so much to the number, but it's to the age. And the court had repeatedly throughout this proceeding referred to, you know, a number of underage victims. And it did use the term young women, but it also right before
your argument is with the number. Undoubtedly, there is at least one victim underage, right?
That's correct.
So your quarrel is with the number. How many women were underage?
Were underage, that's right.
Right.
And I subsequently clarified that to the judge. We said maybe they're not the most artful, but not girls. It's girl because only one underage victim, we're only aware of one underage victim who testified in this case. And then the court, I think, said something that makes clear first that it was relying on a high number of underage victims. Said, no, I know that there's more than one. And I know that from two places. I know that from the trial, where we had one who testified. The court actually said two. I think even under the government's version, that was mistaken because one of the women who testified was over the age of 16. She was 17. And then the court said, and I know it from another place. I know it from the material witness cases. The quote said, I know there were girls for the purposes of sentencing and the seriousness of the offense. I spoke to some of the girls whom we held as material witnesses before trial, If you remember, that was a whole issue before trial, just at the beginning of trial. So I know there were multiple girls.
Now,
so
of the seven identified in the PSR, how many were minors?
Well, I mean, of the seven identified in the PSR, there were three that were purportedly minors. Only one, however, testified at trial, and there was only any indicia of only evidence presented at any point regarding one, and that was the one who testified. One of the other ones who was AI was the subject of the material witness hearings, and that's how the judge said, actually, in her order denying our motion to unseal, said, I know about this other one from the material witness hearing. She stated
that
the
judge would also know about the other one from the pre-sentence report.
Well, I mean, the pre-sentence report is an interesting thing in this case. The government basically submitted a letter to the probation office, said, look, here's what we think happened here. They said in many of those places, look, no one ever presented this evidence at trial. So it was just basically a bare factual proffer, the letter that they submitted. In response, we said this cannot be the way that this is done. We deny these factual allegations. This cannot be the way that this is done. And I think this gets directly to Justice Scalia's observation in Booker that, you know, these pre-sentence reports can sometimes be bureaucratically prepared, hearsay-riddled documents, and that's exactly what happened here. We objected to that and said this cannot be a way of making this relevant conduct finding. The PSR noted our objections and ultimately said that these issues are unresolved. Now, at the first sentencing, the district court didn't appear to rely on the number of victims or the age of the victims directly, never mentioned anything like that, so this wasn't really resolved in that proceeding. When we came back, it was clear, and we came back sometime later, and it was clear at that time the district court did have this number of underage victims in mind. It said there was six, and that was said right up front in response to our allocution. So this was, at the resentencing, an important factor. And at that point, we said, Judge, there was only evidence presented concerning one underage victim. And certainly there was only a finding by a preponderance, only anything to support preponderance of the evidence by one. Now, at the end, the judge does refer to the material witness hearings as another source of evidence, but that brings us to our Rule 32 claim, which is that Rule 32 is supposed to provide, if the judge wants to rely on material from outside the record, something the defense doesn't have access to, then Rule 32, and I think this is an embodiment of due process, states that the judge has to notify us and provide a summary, and this can be done in camera. I mean, it can be done in ways to protect privacy and everything else. But the judge does have to notify us that intends to rely on such information and has to give us a reasonable opportunity to rebut that. And in this case, I think, the court, when we challenged its finding on the number of underage victims, when we objected, its first place it went to was the material witness hearings. So this was clearly information that was very important, or whatever went on there, and again, we don't know, whatever went on there was very important to the court. And if you look at the cases on Rule 32, I think from McCants, McCants really emphasizes, this court's case emphasizes the importance of Rule 32 as embodying due process, but also that it's important for us to have the opportunity and then for this court.
Can I, just to get some context here, this was not an error in the guidelines calculation, correct?
Not an error, no.
And the sentence imposed was a below-guideline sentence, right? Okay.
The
question is, your point still stands, yeah. But I'm just trying to kind of proceed down the. It's not, as we often get, there was an error in the guidelines calculation.
No.
It's rather that in exercising the 3553A discretion, the district court had an erroneous fact in mind.
Yeah. Well, the district court itself directly connected this to this 3553 factors on numerous occasions during the sentencing. It said, look, it's for the purposes of seriousness of the offense, the nature and circumstances of the offense. So this was clearly something important to the district judge in assessing the 3553 factors. Now, did the number of victims influence any specific offense characteristic? No. There was no need to make a finding on that. But I think in this 3553 world, if the district court is going to emphasize a fact as important to the 3553 factors, then it has to be something that
I thought that to read it in whole, and you're probably going to disagree with this, but it seems like what the district court was saying after you made the correction was there were a lot of young women, seven, and that's what was in the PSR. And the question is young women still referring back to the number of women under 16 as being somehow enhancing the sentence that the district court would otherwise give. That's your point.
Well, that's what I mean. And if there's ambiguity here, and there's again, there's only one clear statement at the outset. There's 16. But if there's ambiguity about what subsequently happened here, then I think that that has to go to Mr. Bryce. And we're talking about a limited, we're talking about a remand just for a resentencing here.
Right.
And you know, in Lemon, this court's, I think, lead case on this, United States versus Lemon, on, you know, the reliability of information in this context, they said if there's a possibility that misinformation infected the sentence, then the court needs to remand.
Your brief makes a broader point, or has a broader thrust with reference to the conduct that occurred before the sentencing.
Yes.
And you're arguing for a ruling by this court that the district judge displayed sufficient indicia of partiality that we should vacate and send back to a different judge.
Yes.
You're not abandoning the broader point. You're simply focused this morning on the direct point.
I would call maybe the narrowest ground for reversal.
Okay. Yes. Thank you.
But that is our request, Your Honor.
How would the remedy of looking at the sealed witness transcripts, the sealed transcripts, respond to this issue in any way?
Well, I mean, I think it might. It would go to the Rule 32 issue. I know that we sort of have requested that for numerous reasons, but most importantly, it would go to the Rule 32 issue.
Okay.
I think we could see whether that was harmless or harmful.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Lauren Bates on behalf of Appellee. Your Honor, here, the district court at sentencing did make a statement at the kind of beginning of the court's participation in the sentencing hearing that was prefaced with, let me ask you a couple questions here. The court...
Although Mr. Jeffress focused on that, I think we should go back to things that happened in the trial. And the conference between the court and the government on how KH should be presented struck me as unusual, to put it charitably. So would you, talk about that a bit. In your brief, you characterize it as just an ordinary case of consultation on logistics. To me, it doesn't sound like logistics at all.
The discussion, in one hand, dealt with the logistics of how KH, who was being held on a material witness,
it had a logistical aspect.
Was going to enter the courtroom.
But that was not the focus of either the government or the court.
The government, had a reason for having a...
Yeah, you wanted to have a staged presentation for the jury of the confrontation between witness and client. You wouldn't call that ordinary, would you? I've been away from the trial courts a long time, but I don't recall ever a lawyer asking the judge, bring this witness in any particular fashion so the jury can see this reaction we want to get. And I don't recall a judge cooperating with any such thing.
No, I think perhaps it's not ordinary, given that it is not often that the government's witnesses or witnesses are held prior to trial on material witness.
They're held on various
cases. Quite often held.
Here, this was rather unique set of circumstances, a trial that involved minors.
Why, under any circumstance, would the government have a right to ask the court that a witness be brought in so the jury could see how the witness and the defendant react to each other?
And right above all, a right to work it out ex parte.
I think those are two separate issues. Here, even appellant has not alleged that it is improper for the jury to have the opportunity to see a witness.
That's not even
reaction.
Close to the issue. It's not the issue of what the jury might see being improper. It's whether the manner in which the government manipulated the jury's view is improper.
The government here requested that the opportunity to have the jury see what a jury often is permitted to see, which is see a witness's reaction to being confronted with entering the courtroom and confronted with the defendant for the first time in that situation. Whether or not this was best handled ex parte is a different question.
Do you have anything suggesting that it was permissible to handle it ex parte? Anything at all? Because your brief totally avoids that issue. You talk of it both as a logistical matter, then you also address the merits, assuming it had been open, of allowing this a staged presentation to occur. But that neither of those points addresses the combination of ex parte conference on a staged presentation of a witness.
I mean, I think that the argument could be that the government is not required to kind of show its hand to defense counsel as to what it expects its evidence to show. This may have been an aspect of...
Well, if it's asking for an extraordinary remedy in terms of the way the witness appears in the courtroom, I can't imagine why it wouldn't be expected to show its hand, as you say.
Not just showing its hand, it's ex parte communication with the court. That's not your hand.
No, and this was handled ex parte. I think the question when looking at a claim of bias under Section 455, however, is really whether the fact that this was ex parte, putting aside, you know, this court in Edmond has recognized that things better left unsaid or mere impropriety are not grounds for finding bias on the part of the trial judge.
Counsel, what you have here is the appearance, certainly, of the prosecution and the court, to use an informal term, in cahoots to produce a result favoring the prosecution.
I mean, I don't
know. If that's an accurate description, how can it possibly not create the appearance of partiality?
I mean, here the court's role in this was in responding to a request by the government, a request that is not improper for the jury to hear. The court was not, in handling this request, displaying any deep-seated antagonism toward appellant.
Why was it done ex parte?
I mean, I don't have the answer to that.
You've been all this far, all the way up here to oral arguments. The prosecutor who did this is in your office.
Yes.
And you have not gotten the answer to that?
I mean, that's not in the record before this court. I think that perhaps, given the fact that this case involved a number of proceedings that dealt with the same juvenile witnesses that were sealed relating to mental health issues and the material witness, that perhaps this was inadvertently kind of handled as thinking.
What you seem to be suggesting is that because of the material witness background, it was only natural as an historical matter that the prosecution and the court should be in league together.
I think in league is here the government asked for a logistical accommodation that was not improper. This was not something that the court could not have permitted.
Yes, but it asked for it ex parte.
The fact that this may have occurred ex parte.
There's no need to say may have occurred. It did occur.
Improperly occurred ex parte. I think is a very different question than whether it demonstrates the amount of bias necessary to rise the level. This court has recognized that even if conduct may violate a judicial canon, for example, as this court recognized in Microsoft and other cases, that does not necessarily implicate bias under Section 455.
What did we do in Microsoft on that issue?
It was a very different...
Send it back to a different judge, didn't we?
Case. Yeah. It was not a...
I noticed the cases you cite in your brief, the results are not the results you wanted.
Yes,
Donato you rely on in your brief, or we reverse the conviction and send it back for retrial to a different judge.
I mean, here the ex parte communication was a single, I mean, it took amounted to at most 10 pages in the trial transcript of 5 days, 900 pages.
I hadn't done a page count.
Quite unlike cases such as Microsoft and the other cases cited by appellant, where there were extensive conversations that went to the heart of the case, that went to
you
the merit.
You thought it was important enough to approach the judge ex parte about, and yet you don't think now that it's, I don't mean you personally, but somebody in your office thought it was important enough to go make an extraordinary request of a judge ex parte, and now you're saying it's not important? Why did you risk your conviction for something that's not important?
I would say that... best, there was not ample thought that went into this. I don't know that the prosecutor appellant attempts to argue that the government must have believed that the court would have done this for the government, which is why they approached ex parte. If that was the case,
Well, they presumably approached ex parte for the reason they were doing everything, for the advantage of the government in the trial. Mm-hmm.
I don't know that appellant can point to any advantage that the government secured.
You did. You said that the government wanted the jury to see the reaction between these people. Right. They don't have to point to the advantage you already brought up.
The question is whether the government obtained that advantage because this was ex parte. I don't think it made it easier.
We at an absolute minimum.
And I think
that's the problem with ex parte. Neither they nor we can know whether it made any difference or not. If they had been there, if it had not been ex parte, then we'd have a record of what the discussion was. We can't know that. The ex parte by itself prevents us from finding out whether the ex parte nature hurt.
I mean, here, there's been no suggestion that this was improper for the judge, setting aside the fact that it was handled ex parte, that it was improper for the judge to allow the government's witness to enter the courtroom in a manner that allowed the jury to see the way that the witness reacted to seeing the defendant.
On the substance of this, putting aside the ex parte, which is the key issue, it seems to me, but on the substance of it, I understood the government to want the witness to be treated like other witnesses and not perceived as coming as having been held. Is that fair, or what was going on? What was the government's motivation?
I think the government
aside the ex parte
proffered its motivation, which is that it wanted the jury to be able to see what reaction the witness had to being confronted with the defendant in the courtroom.
And that's in the record, and you're stuck with that. That was the reason. It was not logistics, it was strategy.
And
if it had been what Judge Kavanaugh suggested, that would have been logistics.
And
this sounds like trial strategy.
Well, that's the government's reason. I think what the government was asking the court was to make, and perhaps this court disagrees, but to make a logistical,
arrangement, because then we immediately suspend proceedings after the witness has appeared, right?
Mm-hmm. The judge does to conduct a voir dire outside the presence
right.
of the jury.
And the defense counsel was unsurprisingly startled by this sequence.
I think the defense counsel wanted to ensure that the voir dire occurred. I don't know that the record can reflect startled, but yes, questioned the court to ensure that that voir dire was going to occur. And then that is what the court then next handled with the witness.
The ordinary logistics would be more favorable to the government than the logistics that would occur if the witness were brought in as if held, right? The ordinary logistics of a witness who was not held.
I mean, in this case, I think the government believed that.
I guess I'm saying, and maybe disagreeing with both sides here, which is I'm not sure it's purely logistics or purely strategy. I think it's both. And one way of doing the logistics was more favorable to the government than the other way of doing the logistics.
Yeah, and I do. I think the government had a reason for asking for this logistical accommodation.
Right.
Whether or not it ends up more favorable to the government, I think, is really a question that there's not always an answer to. Oftentimes,
you obviously
thought it was more favorable to the government.
Right.
Yeah.
And then the question, the district court is participating in that ex parte. That's the.
And I think setting aside, again, looking at the question here is whether there was bias or impartiality on the part of the district court judge such that it infected the resentencing here. This is an appeal after a resentencing hearing where this is being raised for the first time. And the government submits that this was this single act, whether or not it was improper or better handled in another way, just was not sufficient to rise to that level.
That gets us perhaps past that one and into the more narrow question about the sentencing, the allegation of error on the sentencing. I want to read you something that another circuit said once. Now, granted, this is not binding because it's another circuit, and it's from pre-guidelines days, but U.S. v. Looney, the Fourth Circuit, from the several statements of the district judge, it seems clear that he was greatly impressed by his understanding the number of homicides perpetrated in New York by the use of guns, which the defendants had caused to be distributed in that city, and that the severity of the sentences he imposed is attributable, at least in part, to this understanding. Whether there had been homicides in New York by the use of guns supplied by the defendants, and if so, how many, were facts which were not disclosed in the evidence adduced at the trial of Looney and the other defendants. They nowhere appear in the record. There is no suggestion they should remain confidential, and their accuracy is unverified. Indeed, from the response of the prosecutor at the second sentencing, it appears that some of the facts remembered by the district judge were never established or provable. Does that sound sort of like it's parallel to what we have here? There it was how many murders, here it's how many underage prostitutes. But in both cases, the judge supplied a number which he or she, he in that case, she in this, received outside the record, which was not in the record, and was apparently not correct in both cases. What does that sound parallel to this? I know it's not binding.
In very important respects from the limited passage that you read, Your Honor, I would say no. There the court in the Fourth Circuit seemed to reference facts not disclosed that nowhere appeared in the record. Here, the testimony at trial, and as the court recognized in a subsequent order that dealt with denying the request
to
unseal.
Did the testimony at trial say there were six?
The testimony at trial included testimony from three women.
Were they underage?
K.H., who was 14 at the time of her involvement with the appellant. Another woman, C.M., who was 17 at the time of her involvement with appellant, and another woman, Shakita Proctor, who was 19.
So you had two underage.
There was testimony from those witnesses about the involvement of other women with
Did
appellant.
Did their age come out?
I believe specifically KH speaks about, and it's also reflected in the pre-sentence report, about the time when she first met appellant.
Was
with
the
her
judge's
friend,
number
H.
right or wrong? Was the judge's number right or wrong?
The judge's initial statement about trying to recall if there were six under the age of 16, I don't think that there's support for that. However,
right.
It's important
so therefore
to
therefore it is parallel to the Looney case in that respect.
No, because the judge then, just a few lines later in the transcript, says and clarifies, they weren't children, actually. It was six or seven young women. That's page 19.
Isn't it very, very young?
She may have, at times she used very.
And I think there's a very, very there.
Very, very.
The court clearly recognized they weren't children, actually. There was testimony from whether you're counting young or, for this purpose, is based on 16 or 18. I mean, there was testimony that there were 17-year-old, 19-year-old. There's no question that there were multiple young women.
Yeah, at that point, I think she just said young women. There weren't children. Actually, young women were caught up in this, and it seemed to me at the time it was six or seven.
I mean, and the court must also look at the fact that later in the transcript, when the court is pressed by appellant's counsel on one aspect of it, that the court makes clear that it wasn't making reference to anything in specific. That the record shows that he had as many as seven young women who were prostitutes for him. There was evidence at trial presented that about seven women, and the pre-sentence report here reflected various ages of number of these women. This was not information that the court was incorrect that there were many young women, and this was not information that had not been disclosed or that did not appear in the record as the passage. Judge Santel, that you referenced from the Fourth Circuit, this was information that the court properly had before it and that the court explained was relevant in considering the nature and circumstances of the offense here.
Could we go back to the ex parte communication? I was just wondering, does the U.S. Attorney's Office here guide assistant U.S. attorneys to avoid ex parte contacts with judges on what are effectively merits issues?
Yes,
it does. But apparently not quite as effectively as we would all hope.
And again, I think that this was an issue that perhaps was better not handled ex parte, that in one vein could have been viewed as logistical, given the circumstances here, to the extent that it did end up touching on the merits. I agree that this could have been better handled.
Even
the
if
question,
it's purely
though,
logistical, why would there be an ex parte conversation between the judge and one attorney on logistical matters in a trial? Wouldn't the defense attorney have a right to be present, even if it's treated as purely logistical?
I can imagine certain.
You don't have to imagine. That's a yes or no question. Don't do any imagining. Wouldn't the defense have a right to be represented at a conference between the judge and the prosecuting attorney, even if it's a purely logistical matter?
I think, again, it depends what the view of purely logistical encompasses. No, could it have been better if appellant had been present to hear the government's request and the court allowing
the
witness to...
One of the problems is if it's apparent at any point that the judge and the prosecutor have been conferring and the defense has not been made party thereto or aware of it, nobody knows what has occurred. The appearance of bias is inescapable when you have an ex parte conversation because the defense doesn't know what you're talking about. If it gets out to the public doesn't know what you're talking about. They just know that the judge and the prosecutor, as Judge Williams said, appear to be in cahoots. If they're ganging up and having conversations, then the defense can't be there.
Again, this was a single instance where the government had this ex parte communication. That looking at the record as a whole, which this court has said in Edmonds is how a claim of bias is assessed, that this did not rise to the level of indicating that the judge was somehow displaying deep-seated antagonism towards appellant, or that in handling this communication ex parte where it did not go to the heart of the issues here. Again, this was a jury trial where it was ultimately a verdict that was rendered by the jury after hearing the evidence. That this, even if better handled in a different manner, did not rise to the level.
You make a forfeiture argument, but I don't recall your brief ever saying your understanding as to when defense counsel learned or could with diligence have learned of this ex parte conversation.
And this, I don't know if the government's position would be that at the time of the direct appeal, when the transcripts have been prepared that encompass the ex parte communication, given that the trial transcripts are what is referenced and form the basis now of this claim, that information was available.
I see.
What information was in the PSR about number of victims?
There was information that included a reference to seven different individuals on page 5. There's a reference to the dates of birth of two juveniles. In paragraph 7, there's a reference in the next paragraph to two other women with no reference to their ages, other than adult women. There's a reference to HH also being a juvenile, also in that paragraph 9. And then in the footnotes on page 6, there's a reference to a 17-year-old in footnote 3. And then there's also a reference to another adult, Shakita Proctor, who testified at trial. So it was a reference to seven specific identified individuals.
Three of whom were minor.
Three were under 16 or characterized as juveniles, one who was 17, and three referenced as adults.
Three adults, one 17, three under 16? So I'll make sure I get it right.
Two with specific dates of birth, mm-hmm. placing them under 16, and one who was only referred to, this is HH, as a juvenile.
Okay, thank you.
Unless there are any further questions, we ask that the judgment of the district court be affirmed.
Thank you.
Very briefly, Your Honor. Ultimately, although she did say seven young women at some point, which I think is an imprecise term and doesn't really show the point, but But ultimately, she certainly, the district court certainly relied on the fact that there were multiple juveniles.
And there were, in fact, multiple juveniles, weren't there?
Well, the only one that there's only one that testified at trial, and that
but
was.
She had information in PSR, at least, and perhaps elsewhere, but at least in the PSR, which is a legitimate source of evidence, she had information that there were multiple juveniles, right?
Well, there was an allegation in the PSR based on what the government said, but that evidence was never presented at trial. There was never any evidence at all.
Well, there's lots of things in PSRs that are not in trials, aren't there?
Well, we also objected.
Did you dispute the age at sentencing?
We objected to the government's factual representations is the way we phrase it. We said we object to the government's factual representations based on nothing more than a letter that they submitted ex parte to the probation office, and the district court never resolved that one way or the other. And when the district court did say that the district court didn't refer to the PSR at all in making this finding during the resentencing. The only thing the district court did refer to was the witnesses who testified at trial and the material witnesses.
This gets to a larger point I have, which is this was a resentencing on a narrow issue, at least according to our original decision in this case. And so I read the district court as the primary issue, maybe the sole issue for the district court seemed to be, given what the Court of Appeals said on the one issue, should I keep the same sentence as I think the government advocated? You advocated going to 120 months.
Right.
And her view was, given what the Court of Appeals had said on the one issue, I'm going to lower it by 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So there wasn't I don't think you can look at the resentencing as the sole proceeding. I'm not saying you are, but in the context of the initial sentencing, the resentencing was really concerned just with this one specific.
We actually litigated that specific question there. The government said what Your Honor just said, and I think McCoy is the case up here and so forth, but then we argued the other, and she said, and the district court ruled that this was a remand for a full resentencing, and I think
right.
The district court was right, and the government isn't.
I understand that, but then the district court said, I'm incorporating by reference, there's a specific colloquy at the end of the transcript, I'm incorporating by reference what happened at the original sentencing as well, right? In other words, the original sentencing wasn't wiped out in the sense from the district court's analysis of the case.
No, but there had never been any relevant conduct finding with respect to
right.
underage victims at that sentencing either.
Right.
And if I could just briefly on the ex parte, I think one just issue, and the court's covered very well, but just one issue is that when the initial approach was made, there was also, by the prosecutor, there was also an ex parte communication about, look, hey, I was at the photo spread for this particular person. She cried at the photo spread. She's so in love with him. And I think that's the statement, you know, it's a communication on the merits ex parte, which really doesn't go with a criminal case. But moreover, that's why she's impressing upon the district court, that's why we need this moment. It's going to be something that's going to impress the jury. And I think that gives the flavor very much of, this was something done for a tactical reason. There's no other explanation.
A couple questions on that, just to flesh this out. Putting aside the ex parte issue, which is, as Judge Williams said, Judge Sintel and myself, the important issue, was how the witness was brought in. Was that some way improper?
Putting aside the ex parte, I think they're sort
yes.
of intertwined. And here we're looking really at the district court's What was bringing
the district court had both attorneys present and then said, this is how the witness is going to be brought in. Would that have been improper?
I don't think so.
Okay.
But the reason why the district court did this and the reason why it was all done ex parte, I think reveals, if somebody is to look at that from the outside, a reasonable observer, they're going to say, the district court is doing this, especially given her statement, I want the jury to see the reaction between these two. I want the jury to see that. Any reasonable observer is going to say that judge has aligned, that district court has aligned itself with one side
mm-hmm.
or the other. And I think the government basically said, you know, this probably was because she had overly identified herself with the victims in this case and so had sort of given up the cold impartiality of a district judge.
And why isn't the conviction being challenged?
Well, I mean, this is an appeal of the resentencing. This is appeal resentencing, but also in Microsoft, I think this court rightly said that you should tailor the remedy to the scope of the misconduct. Sentencing is the.
Your theory is you didn't discover the information about the bias until a point where it was too late to bring it up in the first appeal. But theoretically or analytically, the bias would infect the entire proceeding if there were bias of the kind you allege, right?
Yeah, but again, Microsoft says you tailor the remedy to the scope of misconduct. I mean, they left Congress left it when they passed 455, left the tailoring of the remedy wisely to district courts to say. And sentencing is going to be the moment where a district court's bias against the defendant is going to have, I think, the very most impact. Sentencing is the moment where the district court judge gets to exert.
But it was a below guidelines sentence, right? But I mean, that's a little bit of a mismatch as well.
The guidelines here were subject to dispute, but even so, I think under, you know, it's supposed to be a 3553 now, and Your Honor's talked about the magnetic pull the guidelines may still have in these cases, and I think that's making that mistake. I mean, if you looked at comparable cases, which we did in our sentencing memo, I mean, they were below, a lot below this. So,
right, your point could be, well, if she weren't biased under your theory, the sentence would have been even farther below the guidelines, right?
We were hoping for much better, obviously.
Yeah, you wanted 120 months.
Okay. Let me back you up just a moment before we've held you well over your time, but we do that a lot. As far as the judge's error as to how many underage victims were here, is it really material how many? I mean, you do not contest. You're talking about how the information is entered from the PSR. You don't really contest the accuracy that there were multiple underage prostitutes, do you?
Well, we don't think there was only one proven, Judge.
Well, that's not what I'm asking you, is it? Do you really contest that there were multiple underage prostitutes?
I've only seen evidence of one.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
Case is submitted.